Welcome to a night of total terror.
What would Halloween be without a scary zombie movie just like this classic one?
Night of the Living Dead. The dead who live on living flesh.
Whoa, Night of the Living Dead. That is the classic. That is the, I guess, the granddaddy of all horror movies for Halloween. And for the rest of this hour, we're going to be talking about what drives those zombies, our brains. What's going on in their brains? Not the normal ones, but the zombie brains, which, as they show you in the movie, are very hungry for flesh, human flesh. Well, my next guest has taken the necessary precautions in case there ever is an outbreak of zombies. He is studying the zombie literature and the movies to be able to understand what is going on in the brains of the undead and see if there could be maybe a vaccine to protect us from those zombies, just in case. Dr. Stephen Schlotzman is a co-director of the Medical Student Education in Psychiatry at Harvard Med School, as well as staff child psychiatrist at Mass General Hospital. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Schlotzman.
Thanks very much. It's fun to talk to you.
It is fun. What made you study zombie brains, or what zombie motivation?
Good question. I was watching, I guess, a little bit over a year ago, Night of the Living Dead was on TV, and it was kind of on that list of movies that, you know, I had never seen and needed to see. Watch it. First of all, it was a totally compelling movie. I love that clip you just played. But I was kind of watching them and thinking there's something, you know, clearly not right about the way they're moving, talking, behaving, acting. They don't really talk. They moan a lot.
Right.
And act. And then I started thinking about what must be going on in their brains to make them act that way. So then I wrote this fake paper about it.
And what did you discover or think what must be going on in there?
I mean, the wonderful thing about writing a fake paper is that I don't, you know, I can make up all the references myself and things like that. So,
right. You had some co-authors, right?
Right. They're some were infected, some were have already deceased, some were humanoids. It was all good fun. So, with the caveat that they are fictional characters,
right.
I kind of decided that there wasn't much of a frontal lobe, which is the region of the brain that allows you to plan and do complex tasks, and also to control impulsive acts to stop you from doing things that if you had two or three more minutes, you might not do it. Mm. I figured they didn't have much of that. They had a whole lot of amygdala going on, amygdalar tone, which is a region of the limbic system that's responsible for very, very base emotions, usually rage, fear, and maybe lust. And then there's an intermediary part of the brain, the anterior cingulate cortex, which helps to modulate communications between higher and lower brain. And I figured that probably wasn't working so good because you figure in normal humans, if that lower brain gets too loud, the anterior cingulate cortex helps to modulate it so the frontal lobe can process it in time.
Right.
But zombies don't process things that well.
Do we know why they're so hungry for human flesh at all?
Well,
or what's going on there?
It's a great question. So we know this one has stymied me. We can say why they're hungry.
Right.
So there is a region of the brain that's responsible for letting you know when your stomach's full. We ignore it all the time, you know, on Thanksgiving and things like that. But the ventromedial hypothalamus, which is a region of the brain that sits below the thalamus, basically receives signals from your stomach and from your GI tract that tells you that you've had enough and it's time to stop eating. And it turns out there are a group of infectious agents that usually exist in animals, sometimes jump to humans. They're usually viruses, borne of viruses, things like that, that make their way into the brain and cause you to ignore those satiety signals. You can also do that surgically. So in mice that have had the anterior ventromedial hypothalamus ablated surgically, they'll just eat and eat and eat and eat until they die, basically.
1-800-989-8255, talking with Dr. Stephen Schlotzman about the psychiatry, I guess, the mind of a zombie. It's never explained. You know, George Romero, who's the father of the zombies here.
Yep.
He never really explains how it spreads, does he?
He's a lovely man.
Yeah.
That's one of the most fun things about this has been getting to meet him and know him. But very learned guy, incredibly well read. He will steadfastly refuse to explain. there are little hints in his movies. In Night of the Living Dead, there's one hint that it was radiation.
It used to be radiation all the time in the old movies. Yeah.
Right, sort of plague stuff.
Right.
It tends to be, I think, whatever freaks us out the most at the current time. So right now we're sort of fixated on, plagues and things. So it's usually a plague that, you know, some kind of infectious agent that's caused the zombification process.
Mm-hmm. And so it's a viral sort of thing, perhaps.
Yeah, so folks will usually turn to virus in the same way that when, you know, your doctor doesn't quite know what it is, but they know you got something, they say it's probably a virus.
Right.
So they'll turn to virus, and virus kind of makes sense. There was this great moment at MGH when I was talking to other folks about this, talking to one of the ID docs, and said, hey, what do you think would work here? And his first thing was, Steve, get serious. We actually have patients to see. But then his second thing was, you got to go with prions, which are the proteins. They're not even
right.
really living that cause things like spongiform changes in the
yeah.
brain. And then at like 1 o'clock in the morning that night, he emailed me and said, I've been thinking more about it. It's got to be more contagious than that. Can you do something with influenza?
that's what you want to get, start spreading it around. It,
exactly.
Zombies are caused by the flu.
Right.
But you actually came up with a scientific term for what's happening in zombies. What do you call them?
So I decided to call it ataxic neurodegenerative satiety deficiency syndrome. So ataxic meaning you don't walk that well, and neurodegenerative means your brain stops working, so you degenerate neurologically. Satiety is the sense that you're full and that's not working, so it's deficient.
Right.
In the paper I wrote, it was originally called RAH, or reptilian aggression hunger syndrome, and that is basically because if you look at a reptile's brain, it's mostly amygdala. There's not much higher brain there.
Right.
But then the International Classification of Disease in 11 in 2012, which hasn't happened yet, of course, decided to change it.
I getcha. Let's go to see what some of our listeners are thinking. Diana in Boston, hi there.
Hi, how are you doing?
How are you doing?
So I'm a medical student here, and I've had friends send me joke articles and some serious things for a number of years because I kind of have this irrational fear of zombies and actually getting over it this year by dressing as one. And I discovered from a psychiatry basis what made me afraid of them. As a small child, we had a rabies epidemic where I was living in Connecticut, and my mother described the features to me and kind of scared the daylights out of me to avoid raccoons that I saw in the yard who were out when they shouldn't be out, who were extremely aggressive, who couldn't be stopped by normal physical, you know, exertions fighting, and who, if they bit me, I might become sick like them. It wasn't until studying rabies in one of my classes in my second year that I realized that those are the exact characteristics of zombies, and this fear that I had of zombies was just a remnant of how my mom had scared me. Subsequently, when I told another friend who's a medical student in New York, she sent me articles about diseases, old case studies in the South, of infectious agents that slowed the heartbeat to a point where, and I, off the top of my head, I can't remember what it was, and that it had fed the sort of zombie heritage, which I know has a long Southern history to it. So
you know a lot about zombies, don't you?
I know a little too much for a person who considers herself a scientist.
But it's kind of flooding. This is good. You're treating yourself. This is good.
Yes.
This is a good thing.
Yeah. So this year I'm going as one. I've got everything, the blood. I got professional prosthetic makeup, and I'm, you know, PTSD treating myself this year.
I'm proud of you.
You not only talk the talk, but you walk the walk.
With all the ataxic movements and everything.
Wow. Happy Halloween, Diana.
Happy Halloween.
Good luck to you. She really has covered the waterfront on that one.
She has. You know, it's interesting. So rabies comes up an awful lot in the discussion. It doesn't quite fit for the pathophysiology because actually rabies creates a kind of hydrophobia where people are afraid of drinking and eating. They bite out of aggression, but they don't bite because they're hungry. So that was why I ended up ruling it out. But you got to consider it. I mean,
great diagnosis.
Yep.
1-800-999-8255. Andrew in Nebraska. Hi.
Hey, I was just wondering if the doctor could explain if there was some kind of difference psychologically between the slow zombies and the ones like the monstrous fast ones that are just terrifying off of 28 days later.
That is like the, you know, when I started doing this, that's like the question. So my first answer is always it's like talking about the DH in baseball. You know, like whether you think the DH is a good thing or not, you really love baseball. So everybody who asked me this question, they all love zombies no matter what. What I would say is that, like, the zombies in 28 Days Later aren't really zombies because they're not really dead. They're infected with the rage virus. They're not like the walking dead. But neurobiologically speaking, they got to be different. They they got to have better cerebellar function than do the Romero-type zombies because they move too fluidly. And they also kind of use pack behavior, hunting behavior, which suggests higher cortical involvement than you would see in Romero zombies, which literally stumble around and kind of get stuck at windows and can't figure out how to open them. So if you were going to write something different about the 28 Days Later type zombies, or for that matter, the remake of Dawn of the Dead had running zombies, which was like this big change from the previous 78 Dawn of the Dead. You'd have to sort of design their brains a little bit differently so that they could communicate with each other and so that they can run more fluidly and sort of do pursuit activities.
Makes most sense to me. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks.
Yeah, I hope you got the analysis you're looking for there. 1-800-989-8255. We're talking about zombies this hour on Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Dr. Stephen Schlotzman about zombies. A lot of people want to ask, so let's see if we can get another question or two in here. Daryl in Austin. Hi, Daryl.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there.
My brother-in-law exhibits all the symptoms of a zombie, and all he eats is Big Macs and Twinkies.
And here we have yet another theory for the rapid dissemination of this horrible disease.
The couch potato zombie.
Right.
Thanks, Daryl.
The question is whether he will turn from Big Macs and Twinkies to human walking flesh, because then we have a problem.
Well, you touched on something before that I didn't realize, and in the description of zombies, is that they're not just eating human flesh, but they're angry, right?
So there's rage.
There's rage, right.
And that's actually one of the most interesting things about the sort of concept of zombies. They appear rageful. They look like they really would like to tear you from limb to limb. That's all based in the amygdala of the brain. What's interesting, though, is if all you are is amygdala, it's not really rage, because rage, as we conceptualize it, is the sort of feeling of wanting to attack and then the cognitive understanding of why you want to attack.
Right.
And if you don't have a higher brain, you can't really understand why you want to fight. That's why in all the zombie movies, it's actually the humans who are their worst enemies. It's pretty easy to outrun a Romero zombie. They stumble around and can't really catch you. So the humans just get bored and turn on each other.
Ah, that's always what happens in the Twilight Zone. Let's go to Stan in St. Bernard, Ohio. Hi, Stan.
Hi.
Hi there.
I actually had a theory that why zombies attack living humans. Because I had learned in a health class that pregnant women, the food they need, that they think they need, the weird cravings, are for some chemical that their body needs for the baby. And so if you're a zombie and you're dead, you're craving and needing living things, like living cells.
So really,
would that make sense that's why they always go after, eating
things.
Humans
living
or living?
Interesting. What do you say, Mark?
Steve, it's a cool concept. So I would say, first of all, we're making all this up, so it can be whatever we want. But from the scientific perspective, that's certainly viable, and that's you do read about that thing, that particular phenomena with syndromes other than pregnancy,
right,
as well. There's also kind of existential explanation that Romero and others will throw around, that they're sort of craving a life force. There's this kind of law, it's no fun being the living dead.
Yeah.
So you sort of crave things that are alive in an attempt to sort of regain this.
Steve, where do you go next with your research?
Well, I have a book, believe it or not, which is just totally funny, since most of my research is on things like adolescent depression and stigma and mental health. But I have a novel coming out that amazingly features a short, bald Jewish guy who looks not unlike me, who tries to save the world from the zombie apocalypse. I'm hoping Hugh Jackman will play me in the movie if it ever gets optioned. But
yeah, I see. He'll look just like you, I can.
Right, exactly. No, there's a lie. We're both carbon-based life forms.
So the book's in the process, and we'll wait for it to happen.
Yes, exactly.
All right, and we'll wish you a happy Halloween.
Thank you too.
And thanks for taking time to be with us and having a lot of fun about zombies. Steve,
my pleasure.
You're welcome. He is a doctor, an MD, Dr. Stephen Schlotzman, who is a co-director of medical student education in psychiatry at Harvard Med School, as well as staff child psychiatrist, as he talks about, at Mass General Hospital. That's about all the time we have for this edition, our Halloween edition. I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Schlotzman. Also, Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Kim Molesky. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we have a Science Friday favorite, the 1,000-pound jack-o'-lantern. 1,000-pound pumpkin is up there. Flora Lichtman put it up there for you for your enjoyment to see, an old Science Friday pick of the week. And I'm sure you'll like to watch that one. Have a great and safe Halloween. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.